The show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Oh, man. Okay, we are ready to move along, getting things rolling with the second hour of the Bucket Strategy Investing program. Hope you've heard it so far. It's been wonderful. I'm Johnny Dean. Professor Rick Plum is back once again with me from Lucia Capital Group. We're here to talk about money, talk about strategy, finance, planning, retirement, whatever. We're here to talk to you about your money. We got a huge assortment, a varied whole basket full of stuff to talk about, topics to go over. But of course, we're going to talk about anything that happens to be on your mind, speaking, of course, in a financial sense here. If you need to get in touch with us here on the show, you can do so. There are a few different ways to do that. Get your questions answered right away. Best course of action is to give us a call. Our number here in the studio, 877-PLANNER. Got some lines open right now, 877-752-6637. We're going to be taking your calls first, so hang on for that. You can also send us your emails, your questions, your comments. Go to wealthed.com and click on the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page. And speaking of Wealth Ed, Wealth Education, be sure to check out all of our financial resources at wealthed.com. You can also contact the Brain Trust there as well. Everyone's situation is different, and you've got the opportunity to meet with a Brain Trust advisor to go over your unique strategy. You should know what your options are. You should trust the Brain Trust network of advisors. They're available to you through a single point of contact. Call Professor Plum or any of the advisors at Lucia Capital Group, 800-644-1150, the off-air number. Once again, 800-644-1150. You can make an appointment and just say hi to the Brain Trust, which, of course, includes Professor Rick Plum. Our phone lines are open. I said we're going to take some calls. We're going to do so right now. We still have a couple of lines open at 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. Professor Plum, we have a question. Ray had called after the show yesterday, so we're getting him on first up this hour. Ray, and I believe Honolulu, Hawaii. Hi, Ray.
Hi, good morning.
How can we help you today?
Well, so first of all, thank you for all your words of wisdom throughout the years. And my question is, if my wife and I want to gift more than $14,000 per calendar year,
right,
what are the tax ramifications for both parties, the giver and the receiver?
Well, there is no tax ramification on the gift portion from the person receiving it. You know, you could give them $1 billion and it's not their responsibility to pay the taxes. It would be your responsibility to pay the gift taxes. Now, the gift taxes really don't, you don't actually pay any gift taxes until the gifts in excess of $14,000 a year exceed $5,450,000 this year. So if you were to give them a very large gift, $5+ million, if all you gave them was $5 million, no tax. If you gave them $14,000 individually and then cumulatively over and above that another $5.45 million from your pocket, okay, now the next dollar is going to have a tax associated with that you're responsible of paying. Now that $5.4 million is the same number and is the same exemption that we can give at our death. So if we give it during our lifetime, it's not available to give at our death. I can't give somebody $5 million today and then die and give them another $5 million when I die. It's the same, basically the same number of gift versus estate. I'm still technically giving them money, whether I give them during my life or give it to them at my death. I've got this $5,450,000 get out of jail free gift estate tax, card that says the government doesn't bill me on that. So you can give them quite a bit. Now, you are supposed to file a 709 gift tax form. Tell me a little bit about you. How much are you and your wife worth combined total together?
Oh, like $1.5 million.
Yeah, and do you play the lottery heavily? You've got some things in the work that's going to make you a Donald Trump-esque type of income, of net worth?
No, I don't see us exceeding $5 million.
And that's $5 million per person, $5,450,000 per person.
Okay.
So it's, give them what you want to give them. If you can afford to give them, $100,000 and you want to give them $100,000, fine. Give them $100,000.
On the other hand, is there any tax advantage of giving that money? Will that reduce my income for this year?
Nope.
No.
The only way it would reduce your income is if I have a stock that I paid $10,000 for and it's currently worth roughly $100,000. And my kids need it for college, they need it for the first-time home purchase, whatever. If I sell it, I get to pay the capital gain on the $90,000 in this hypothetical example. If I give it to them, they get to pay the tax on it. Somebody's still going to pay the tax on it.
Okay, that answers the question. Thank you. That was simple.
All right, Ray, thank you for calling. I'm glad you brought it up. We're going to be talking about this, I believe, tomorrow.
Cool.
A couple of segments devoted to this very subject in the first hour.
It's a confusing area.
Of course it's a confusing area, and it's confusing because we've heard of things like gift tax. When you hear something like gift tax, you assume that somebody is going to be out there paying something, either the receiver or a giver, or it sounds like perhaps you can deduct something by giving a gift. Now, you mentioned here that if you gift stock, appreciated stock, in your example, you said you bought a stock for $10,000, and X number of years later, it's gone gangbusters, it's worth $100,000, and you gift it to somebody, let's say your kid. The amount that you...
The recipient's basis. Now, basis is the starting point for determining gain or loss in the investment. The basis falls across, flows through to the new owner.
Right, so it's really only a $10,000 gift?
No, it's a $100,000 gift.
So I would need to theoretically fill out Form 709 for $84,000 or $86,000.
Right, assuming I hadn't given them any other money for the year.
Yeah.
But we're talking about two different systems, though, and this is where people get confused as well. You've got a gift system that looks at the value of the gift, and you've got an income tax system that looks at the gain or loss on the investment. The gain or loss didn't change when I changed the ownership to my child as a gift to them. So my basis is still, my basis was 10,000, their basis is 10,000. The only time the basis changes, and this is something you probably should never do, is if the value of the gift, when I make the gift, is less than my basis. Let's say instead of paying $10,000 for that hypothetical $100,000 stock, I paid $150,000 for it, and it lost money. And I'm in a low bracket, so the loss does me no good, but my kids are, you know, doctors, lawyers, whatever they are, and they're making bang, you know, big money, and so I give it to them thinking that they can take the loss. Uh-uh. I cannot give a loss to somebody else. The basis on a gift is the lower of the donor's basis or the current market value, the lower. So if in that example I paid 150, it was worth 100, their basis is 100. Flip it around. I paid 100, it's worth 150. Basis is 100.
Doesn't help us at all. Now, the reason it would be a bad thing to do is because you'd be much better off selling it.
Nobody gets the loss.
Selling it, take the loss. Because once you gift it away, the loss is gone and nobody gets
gone.
It.
It's gone. It's gone.
So the better choice in that
At least
example,
I get $3,000 a year to
right,
write
exactly.
off.
Right, exactly. And then you have, in your example, $100,000. Now you can gift over the $100,000.
Yeah, they're still getting $100,000.
Right. And if they like that particular stock and they want to hold on to it, then they can
they
go
can
out
always
and buy it.
It
for $100,000 and be on their way. $14,000. We will cover this tomorrow again, since we're talking about it.
Annual gift exclusion.
Yes.
The annual gift tax-free amount. $14,000 a year per person giving to any individual receiving. As many times as I want to give to different individuals, up to $14,000 a year. There's no limit as to the number of people I can give $14,000 a year and still be a non-taxable gift.
Right. So if you had a whole bunch of money and you were afraid that we had a caller yesterday who said, I just don't want this going to the government. You know, I'd like to give it to my kids. But my concern is that...
Well, we had a call yesterday from somebody who had like 10 grandkids and, you know, they could give, you know, $140,000 away.
Right. Now theoretically, you could have somebody just start handing out $14,000.
Little bundles.
Little bundles on the street corner until they could do it for what? Let's see. If you had about $10 million, you'd have to hand it to about what? 1,000 people? Wait, I'd have to do the math. I don't know what it is. But in theory, you could give that entire fortune away in a year and not have to worry about any type of gift tax. You doing the math for me here?
Yeah, the number just seemed low. 714 people.
That's it? 714 times 14,000? Or times...
10 million.
Times, 10 million.
14,000. 714, and then you got a little bit left over.
And 29 cents.
Well, 0.29% of 14,000.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, 700. Okay, so call it 715,000. That's it. Wow.
715
okay.
people.
So that's what I mean, 715 people. So you have $10 million. This is one way to do it, folks. In fact, if you if
that's since, a good way to get rid of your net worth.
It really is, and it is completely allowed. And if you
totally legal.
If you had two people, a husband and a wife who were both worth that combined, they could cut that number in half to whatever it is.
Well, 357. You know, a husband and wife can give a lot of money. They can give $28,000 per person between the two of them.
Right, but I mean, they could eat through that $10 million twice as quickly.
Yes.
Sure. All right. All right, so gifting, once again, yeah, we'll talk about that tomorrow. We'll give you some of that. This is a good discussion of it here, right here. And maybe try to clear up some of the confusion. You had said that our caller, Ray, could go ahead and give it if he had $100,000.
Give it.
He's supposed to fill out Form 709, and maybe he should to cover the overage. But ultimately, Form 709 only matters if you wind up having to owe a gift tax or an estate tax at the end of your life. All right, 877-PLANNER. PLANNER, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, taking more of your calls. Bucket Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, the Brain Trust. We're here talking to you about your cash, about your dough, about your money, about your retirement, about your savings, and anything else that comes around that particular topic. 877-PLANNER. I just looked. We got every line open right now. How about that? 877-PLANNER. So if you're trying to get in touch with the Brain Trust, now is a really good time to call. You can also email us at our website, wealtheds.com, W-E-A-L-T-H, wealtheds.com. I want to get to a couple of emails here. We had one from Mac in Scottsdale, Arizona, and it looks like he's got three different parts to this question, or perhaps three different questions. So let's find out. Mac in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm 67, single, retired, living mostly off distributions from my IRA. I did a file and suspend last year when I reached full retirement age and hadn't planned on taking Social Security until 70. I was hit with a $17 Medicare increase this year, and I assume I'll get hit with another increase next year unless I start taking Social Security benefits.
You'll probably get hit next year anyway. Don't worry.
Yeah, it's, what is it now, 123?
Roughly.
Yeah, so, well, that's for
but the only
people.
Reason you would not get hit next year is if we do not get another cost of living allowance.
Correct, yeah. All right, my questions are, one, in which month would I have to start taking benefits to avoid next year's Medicare increase? Want all three of them?
Well, we can start. I mean, if you are worried about that. Now, remember, if we get a cost of living allowance increase, you're going to pay the Medicare increase anyway. So the only reason that you would not get an increase in your Medicare Part B premium if you were to start receiving your benefit right now or sometime this year is if we don't have a cost of living allowance. If you have a cost of living allowance, it's going to go to the Medicare increase anyway. So I don't know what you're actually doing as far as this. And the reason you did the file and suspend was to let your benefit grow at 8%. That $17 a month benefit increase cost is a lot less than the increase that you're receiving in your monthly benefit. Mm-hmm. So it's very short-sighted to start taking your benefit earlier than you wanted to, earlier than you had planned on because you'd done the analysis earlier, just to avoid a $25 increase, which you're going to end up paying in the future anyway. The people that were frozen at the $104.90 last year, as soon as we get a cost of living increase, they're going to come up and pay the same amount as everybody else. So it's a short-term freeze on the Medicare premium, but a long-term freeze on the benefit. So I wouldn't do it just for that reason. But if you really want to do it, you have to be receiving it before the end of December. Yeah. Receiving it before the end of December.
Exactly. So apply before that. Okay, that was question one. If I do start taking Social Security benefits and avoid the Medicare increase, then suspend again in a subsequent month, would that trigger the Medicare increase?
Well, it won't trigger a Medicare increase because you're not allowed to suspend again. One time, lifetime suspension after that. No more. No more for you.
No soup for you?
No suspension for you. You've already suspended once, you can't do it again.
Okay, well now this answers his third question. Since I already suspended once, am I allowed to suspend for a second time if I'm still less than 70? Less than 70 has no bearing on it. You cannot do it.
If you suspend your benefit and then restart your benefit, whether it's earlier or at 70, you can't suspend it again. It's a one-time thing. Done.
Yeah.
In your case, if waiting until 70 was the right thing to do a year ago, 2 years ago, whenever you decided to do it, it's still the right thing to do now, unless your longevity has changed. to avoid a very temporary freeze on the, or to avoid a very temporary increase on your Social Security benefit is not a reason to give up an 8% per year increase if you thought that was what was best for you to begin with. It's just not enough to do it.
He has a couple more sentences here, but it really is, once again, we've answered. I searched the Social Security website to find out about RESA spending and sent them an email, but the response just directed me back to their website. Well, you won't really find it there. I was also thinking about starting benefits so I could qualify for a mortgage loan, but I want to be sure, well, I will be able to suspend for a second time. Thanks for your help. I really enjoy the show. Wish I were able to listen every day. Well, again, I mean, starting benefits to do a mortgage loan, I mean,
just take a bigger distribution from your IRA to show the income coming in. A good mortgage broker will be able to help you do that without applying for the benefit. Because if you apply for the benefit, or if you unsuspend your benefit, you're getting it now. You're not going to be able to suspend again.
Yeah, and we should point out, too, that the rules that changed, just to make sure everybody's clear, the rules that changed back at the end of April do not forbid you from suspending your benefits after you turn age 66.
They didn't take away the ability to suspend.
No.
They took away the ability for someone else to receive a benefit from your work record while you've suspended.
Now, this doesn't mean, this also doesn't mean that you can't at age 66 file and immediately suspend.
You can
discernible benefit that I can think of for doing it anymore, because the whole point before was to file. And now that you've filed,
somebody else can take a benefit.
A spouse or whoever.
And the reason to suspend a benefit now is more for somebody who was 62, started their benefit early, so that a dependent child or somebody else could start receiving a benefit from your work record. But by the time you get to 66, 67, they've graduated high school, so they're no longer receiving a benefit. Then you can suspend it and let your benefit grow until age 70. That is the kind of scenario that would make sense for the file and then later suspend to start restart again later. But it's not somebody who immediately files and suspends. It's somebody who filed, received a benefit, somebody else was also receiving a benefit, and then suspended.
Yes, and again, once you've suspended your benefit, you cannot once you start it up after having received it, at the end, you cannot
you can't then resuspend.
Yes. And another important point too here. One of the reasons for taking Social Security at age 62 that isn't brought up all that often is what you just mentioned here.
So somebody else can draw a benefit from you, a dependent child.
Yes.
Or a spouse that's caring for the dependent child. So you can actually get a benefit almost equal to what you're receiving at 62, maybe even more than what you're receiving at 62, which really lengthens that break-even age of waiting because it takes a lot longer to make up the amount of money that you're receiving early. So
So if you have a family member,
again, assuming you're not working.
No. See, here we go again. Yet another piece gets thrown into it that has to be thrown into it. See, you reach age 62, and let's say you have a spouse who's a lot younger than you, who is caring for obviously
later in life with children.
Right, a younger a child, and they could use some benefits. You're age 62, and you say, oh, great. I can apply for Social Security and allow them to start taking a benefit. And you say, well, wait a minute, though. Yes, you can, but you can't be working and making more than $15,000, call it $16,000.
Yeah, well, if you're working, you don't need a retirement benefit.
Well, you see.
How can you receive a retirement benefit if you're working? You're not retired.
Well,
unless you're 66 and working, and then you're retired and working, and you can get both.
And you're perfectly capable of doing that.
Whatever.
Well, you know what? The idea of doing it at age 66 is fine. I think you should just be allowed to go ahead and work.
Well, call Congress for reasons, and present your case to them.
Yeah, they don't. I always get a busy signal. They allow you to do it once you're age 66, but they don't allow you to do it at age 62. And that aces out your family, too.
The retirement earnings test used to go all the way to age 70.
I understand. Now, they lowered it to age 66. It's some sort of compromise.
They lowered it to age full retirement age.
Well, at the time, it was age 66. Or was it? Was it 65 at the time?
65.
Okay, 65. They lowered it to full retirement age, which was a nice thing. It was actually a benefit increase when you think about it. But. Okay. I don't want to get any ideas. We're happy to have what we have, and they haven't taken anything away yet. Who knows what they're going to do. Okay, 877-PLAN. We're going to take a break, but we got more coming up, some more of your emails, some of these retirement myths. We're going to cover those as well. Some leftover topics. We got questions on required minimum distributions 877-PLA-NNER. Professor Rick. Bucket Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, talking to you about your money. 877-PLANNER is our number, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. Now, we got some room on the phone, so give us a call. We were talking a few days ago about required minimum distributions and what is required if you are the owner of an IRA. Professor Plum, just to sort of restate the simplest form, when you are 70 and a half,
the year you turn 70 and a half,
you are required to take a certain amount of money based on the
age you will attain in that calendar year, that right. tax year.
And based on the amount that's in each of right. your retirement accounts of the prior year.
It's a fairly easy calculation. You take the balance as of the end of the previous year, the 1231 last year balance, divided by a factor the IRS has given us, a life expectancy factor the IRS has given us, for the age that you will reach this year. So if I will be 71 this year, I just look up the factor, divide by 26.5. Now, the only people that have a different set of tables than the normal table is somebody who has a spouse that's more than 10 years younger than them. If you're married to somebody that has more than 10 years younger than you, you look at a different table. It's not hard to do. You just have to kind of match it up and look it up and find out what your factor is for your life expectancy. But everything else works the same way. Last year's balance divided by this year's life expectancy factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The resulting amount is the required minimum distribution.
Yes. Now, if you it's the age that you will be at the end of the year. So if you turn 70 and a half in, say, March, your required minimum distribution, let's say in this year, is this year, but you don't use the 70 factor. You use the age 71.
Because you will turn 71 during this year. And the other thing is, for somebody who's passed away who's in required minimum distribution age, maybe they pass away towards the beginning of the year when they're 71, 72, and their birthdays would have been later in the year. Well, you use the age that they would have attained if they had survived.
Yes. It's as if they were still alive because
right.
they still
it's
have
still
to
their
take,
required minimum distribution.
Right, for that year only. Now that you mention that, though, so that those are the basics of required minimum distributions. And yes, the first one you can postpone until the first quarter of the following year. All the same rules still apply. You're just doing it later on. They give you a little bit of time.
And you don't recalculate it. You don't
yes.
go to the next 1231 balance. You just use the exact same number.
Right.
You just take it out later in the, next quarter, and then do again for the same year for the next required minimum distribution.
Now, a couple of questions came up after we talked about that I haven't had the chance to get to, so I'm just going to throw them in now. By the way, if you have questions, 877-PLANNER. We got room on the phones right now, 877-PLA-NNER. Is what if you're still working after the age 70 and a half? Is there a required minimum distribution?
Is it an IRA?
Well, they don't say. That's just the question. Let's
assume IRA,
there is an IRA.
If it's an IRA, yes, you have a required minimum distribution. If it is a former employer's retirement plan, yes, you have a required minimum distribution. If you own 5% or more of the company you're working for, yes, you have a required minimum distribution. The only people and the only account that you can get away with not taking the required minimum distribution if you're working is that employer's plan. The employer that you are working for after 70 and a half, and you don't own 5% or more of the company, that one, that specific plan, and only that plan, can be postponed because you're still working. But a SEP, that's an IRA. Still have to take a required minimum distribution. Simple IRA, it's an IRA. Have to take a required minimum distribution. If I have plans from previous employers, have to take required minimum distribution. Only the plan with the current employer is eligible for the deferral.
Yeah, and that would be 401ks, 403bs, 457. But anything that's classified as an IRA doesn't matter because it's not connected to your work. you're still going to have
Once the contribution is made, it's not connected with the work.
No, I understand. Yeah, yeah. You're still going to have to take it. So that's what happens if you're working after age 70. Now, question is this. What about a required minimum distribution on a spousal beneficiary? You started to talk about this a little bit. Let's say that the spouse now inherits or doesn't inherit. Well, yeah.
It would
inherits,
have to.
Inherits the IRA or the 401k or whatever. It is now theirs. Let's say that the person who passed away has already taken their required minimum distribution for that year.
Well, a spouse beneficiary has different options than a non-spouse beneficiary. And the key one is they can roll it into their own name and treat it as their own. Now, if you've got a married couple, you know, 75 years old and 65 years old, and the 75-year-old passes away, they are in required minimum distribution age. The required minimum distribution for that year, the year they passed away, still has to be taken because once they got into the year, they have a required minimum distribution. Live or die, they have a required minimum distribution for that year. But then once that RMD has been taken, the money can be transferred over to the spouse beneficiary and it can be put into their own IRA. It's the only time we really can commingle different people's IRAs when you have a current spouse. The current surviving spouse, you know, can take it over and put it in their own name as if it was their IRA the entire time. And if they're younger, like I was in this example, the person's only 65, now they don't have a required minimum distribution until they reach 70 and a half because they are under the age that they need to take required minimum distributions. And so a lot of times we'll look at how old is the surviving spouse. Now, depending upon, again, how old the surviving spouse is, maybe instead of 75 and 65, we've got a married couple 55 and 53. Well, we don't want to roll it necessarily into the surviving spouse's name. Because now if they roll it into the 53-year-old's name, and that 53-year-old needs some money from that account at any time between then and 59, their age 59 and a half, it's a 10% penalty. So it would be better. A surviving spouse also has the ability to defer taking any distributions from the beneficiary IRA, the spousal, the IRA of the deceased IRA, until the deceased would have been age 70 and a half. So that 55-year-old,
right.
the death of the owner of that account gets you out of the 10% penalty, as long as it stays in that account.
Yeah, so keep in mind that if you're in the unfortunate situation of having to deal with a spouse who passes away and you are of a certain age, let's say under age 59, 59 and a half, and you think you might need that money, it's probably a better idea, Professor Plum, to leave the IRA in the name of the deceased spouse.
It's a form of beneficiary IRA. We can create the idea that, yes, tell the custodian that the person has passed away, that the spouse is now controlling it, and it's for the spouse, but it's not being rolled over to the spouse's IRA yet. It's still in the decedent's name. It's still the decedent's IRA with the spouse as the beneficiary. The spouse as beneficiary can take distributions or not take distributions mm-hmm. as they see fit. No penalty because it's not their IRA. It's
right.
a decedent IRA.
Still taxable, but no penalty.
It's going to be taxable no matter what.
Either way. Now, again, well, as you just said, if the person who passed away was under age 70 and a half, the spouse who inherits the IRA can elect to wait until that person would have been age 70 and a half.
Until they would have had their own required minimum distribution.
Yes, and then they stretch that out to their own life expectancy.
Right, and then they roll it into their name once they're 59 and a half and everything's good.
Yeah, that's how that works. Okay, one last question on this. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. What about a non-spouse beneficiary with regard to required minimum distributions?
Well, the first thing you have to know is how old was the person that died? Were they at required minimum distribution age? Meaning, had they made it into the year where they have a required minimum distribution or not? If they died before they got to the required minimum distribution year, then there's no RMD for the year they died because there wouldn't have been one if they had lived. But then the non-spouse beneficiary needs to start taking an RMD the next year. The next year it is based on the beneficiary's life expectancy and then stretched out over their life expectancy. Or the beneficiary, if the person dies before they get to required minimum distribution age, the beneficiary has 5 years to completely dissolve the IRA. So if they don't take a distribution in the first year, they've got 4 more years to take the money out. They can take it out 20% a year. They can take it all out in 1 year. They can take any amount they want. But it has to be gone by the end mm-hmm. of the 5th year. The only way to stretch it out is to start taking required minimum distributions the year after the year of death. If you miss that one, you're stuck with the 5-year rule. Now, on the other side, if the person that died that owned the IRA was required minimum distribution age, the five-year rule goes away. You have to, you know, either base it on the owner's life expectancy or the beneficiary's life expectancy going forward. There is no five-year rule at that point.
Yeah, and you might as well do it on the beneficiary's life expectancy, which normally, I think, gives you a little bit more flexibility. You can always take more, and so that's not the issue.
They always take more. People are real worried about the beneficiary IRA required minimum distribution for the first year or two or three, and then after that, it's like, just give me the money.
Give me the whole money.
Depending on the size.
In spite of the fact that it could put them into a higher tax bracket, like, in fact, it often does. But you know, hey, it's like, okay, so there's a $150,000 IRA.
I'll take 50 of it this year.
Yeah.
That'll satisfy the RMD.
Right, exactly. Well, that will satisfy the RMD, and it will lower the RMD for the subsequent year.
But I'll take 50 then, too.
We'll take 50 then. In fact, you know what? Just give me the whole thing. And, of course, you know, after that, you're going to wind up probably losing a good $30,000 of it in taxes. But at that point, what do you care? I think we said that before. You know, if anybody wants to give me $500,000
of it taxable,
it's going to be taxable, and I only wind up with, you know, $350, whatever, I'm perfectly happy with that. Let's do that. Anybody who wants to do that, contact me. All right, 877 Planner. Got some more of your emails. We got some trivia and a whole lot of stuff coming up. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. We've got a few more minutes left in the hour, so if you want to give us a call, now would be the time to do that. 877-752-6637. If we have time, we'll get some more of your emails and some trivia coming up, perhaps. Once again, it all depends on time. I want to get to as many calls as I can, though. 877-752-6637. Let's go next to Jeff in Las Vegas. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Listen, I'm kind of questioning. I have a variable life insurance policy that has about 82,000 cash value in it, and the face value is 100,000. But you know, if I died tomorrow, it'd be probably about 182,000,
right?
Just because of the cash value. The question I got is, if I take in, I guess I've been listening and hearing that it's better to have term life insurance and use the, you know, extra money on a monthly basis to invest it in a different bucket.
Well, let's talk about why you have the insurance in the first place. What's the reason?
The original thought was my insurance was because I've had this policy for 26 years, so it was for taking care of the family if I had a problem, you know.
Okay.
All the girls are gone now, so it's just me and the wife, so.
But it would still be nice to leave her some money if you die, or when you die. I shouldn't say if, it's not an if question.
Right, exactly, you know.
And so now the thing is, you've got a very nice cash value compared to the death benefit. You could, this is one of those life policies where you could potentially start taking a distribution from it. How old are you, Jeff?
I'm 61, and I plan to retire in about 6 years at 67. So, you know, and at that point, at 67 or 70 years old, I'm thinking there's no real point for me to continue to, you know, have a life insurance policy. I'm going to probably just self-fund myself because the wife will be getting, you know, pensions and retirement and all that. She's not going to have that need anymore. So.
Right. Now, do you have a pension?
Yes, I have a, I work for the government, so I get a PERS.
Okay. So you have a potential need for insurance. Now, have you already started receiving your pension?
No, not yet.
Okay.
No.
When you receive, when you sign up for your pension at 66, 67, when you retire, you're going to have the option to take a life only, which will give you a higher income, or take a pension with a survivor benefit that pays a continuation of income to your wife if you die. By having this life insurance...
And there's about a $500 difference between the two.
Right. So by having this life insurance, you could say, let's take the life only, have $500 more a month, according to your numbers, for the rest of our joint life. And if I happen to die too soon, you get $180,000 of life insurance to replace the pension that that goes away if I die too soon. So you
if I took the higher amount, yes.
Exactly. And because you have so much cash value, there may be ways to structure, whether you keep this policy or you go to a different policy, you can structure the policy so that you don't have to make any more premiums. You've got the death benefit for the rest of your life. You have the access to the cash if you wanted to even start taking an income and have the death benefit. I wouldn't just ditch this policy. Whether it was a great one or not great one, right now it's doing a good job for you. It's giving you options that you wouldn't otherwise have. So I think that it's actually doing its job. And I would keep it, and I would actually consider looking at that life-only option. How large is your pension going to be?
I'm going to get probably about $3,000 to $3,400 a month just from that, and probably $2,400 from Social Security.
Okay, so what you could potentially do is use this cash of this $180,000 of death benefit to replace a big chunk of the pension. So it's $3,400 if you provide a survivor benefit, or it's $3,400 life only, your life only?
No, that would be survivor also. If I didn't have it, it would be about $500 more or something like that.
Okay, and the survivor option, will she continue to get $3,400 or will she get 50% of that at $1,700?
No, she would get $3,400.
That's a pretty nice little pension, but you may be able to work this life insurance to create an income. I mean, you've got a good percentage of cash value compared to death benefit. You can use this as a tax-free distribution to enhance the income that you already have. I'm not sure I'd want to get rid of this life insurance yet. Not until we looked a lot deeper into it and what we could maybe use it for, whether it's an income stream, in addition to all the taxable income that you have from pensions and Social Security and other things, having a tax-free income from this, and having a death benefit if you unfortunately died too soon. We do have to look at your life expectancy and things like that. But I wouldn't get rid of it. I would look at using it in a way that is the most efficient for you, but I'm not sure that getting rid of it right now is the best thing. You're right. You don't need other insurance. You probably don't need any term insurance. But I wouldn't get rid of this insurance because of the way it sounds like it's working for you.
Yeah, and you know, so my, you know, the hard part for me is trying to figure out, you know, what I'm looking for 6 years from now is before I want to start using my IRAs and
right.
other stuff that I have, I want to have a certain amount be coming out as a guaranteed.
Right, and we can maybe we can create that from the life insurance. You probably have somebody telling you, let's move it to an annuity so that we can create a guaranteed lifetime income. You can probably create a very good lifetime income from the life insurance policy. The difference is it'll be tax-free if you do it right, versus the annuity could have a taxable event with it. And I don't like that.
Right. Yeah. See, that's what I'm all looking at. I'm trying.
Right. That's why we need to look at this a little deeper than just the phone call here.
Hey, Jeff, I tell you what, because I'm about out of time for this hour, and there's a whole lot more that you could look into on this. If you want to hang on, I can have Professor Plum or one of the Brain Trust advisors just take a look and see what it is you have. But Professor Plum, and thanks for the call, Jeff. I appreciate it. You know, you hate to give something up that.
Whether it was a great investment up to this point
doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
You're at the point.
Here we are today with this $82,000 of cash. What is the best use of this money? Is it to go to some other annuity or something? Probably not. Is it to be able to take a different pension option? Maybe. I mean, there's lots of things you can do.
Yeah, there are. We're out of time. We can't discuss it now. If you need the Brain Trust off the air for this or any other question that you have, you can call them at Lucia Capital Group at the off-air number, 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150. Talk to them about your retirement plan. For Professor Rick Plum, I'm Johnny Dean. This is Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.